Welcome to Nicosia Uncut, produced and presented by Andromahi Sofoklios and Kemal Baykal.
Coming to the end of Olgin's mandate, we discuss what to expect next and the upcoming UN Secretary General reports. We also discuss the hype around the US-Cyprus Strategic Dialogue Agreement and the regional dynamics around Cyprus.
Last but not least, we discussed local politics and the results of the European Parliament elections. Hello, Andromahi.
Hello, Kemal. I am writing on my notes, Nicosia Uncut, the return.
Well, we had to take a little break because of the campaigns for the European Parliament elections. But now that we are back on track, I think it's time to talk a bit about our favorite topic, which is nothing other than Cyprus problem.
Yeah, and strangely enough, while we, in terms of substance, there is really nothing to discuss, but in terms of procedures and things happening behind the scenes, etc., there are issues that we could discuss together.
I think this is the longest that the Cyprus problem had taken a break, probably since 1974 or even before. Since Grand Montana, we know that the sides are not on the same track, and they're not agreeing even on the on where to start it and resume the talks. And Madame Olguin had been appointed to see whether there is a common ground. And back in February 2024, when we produced our episode on that, we were asking about, we are inquiring about the end game of Madame Olguin, and asking what is there any reason to see to start the inquiry. And so far there is no progress. The Turkish/Turkish Cypriot side have insisted that the only way for them to come back to the talks is for their counterparts to accept and acknowledge two-state solution model, and this is a no-go. And so I don't know what's the end game here at the moment.
Yeah, I think that what is becoming increasingly crystal clear is the fact that anything we knew about the Cyprus problem is kind of over. And I believe that maybe this is something that maybe the Greek Cypriot side didn't catch early on, in the sense that we are talking about 7 years stalemate. We have, it's by the time the podcast airs, it's going to be the 28th of June, the day that the Grand Montana conference was started back in 2017. And it's been 7 years of a stalemate. And it's been 7 years in a situation in which de facto Turkey's control on the northern part of the island and the fait accompli of division, basically, have been producing a different setting. And I think that we need to put this in mind when we analyze the situation. And as you said, the Turkish and the Turkish Cypriot side, they have shifted their position to a more adamant stance at the moment. And the question is whether the Greek Cypriot side appreciates the impact of these 7 years of a stalemate, and whether it appreciates them through the light of trying to find the way out, basically, or the key that will unlock the process or the situation. And I'm not sure that we see this happening.
We should be expecting reports of the Secretary General to the Security Council on the Secretary General's initiatives in Cyprus, and also about ANFISIP's current situation. And some people are expecting the reports to slap the Turkish/Turkish Cypriot side. I don't expect this to be the case. Probably they might be mentioning that their position is this. But I also am kind of surprised to talk to some people in certain circles, and they're actually saying that they are also expecting some initiatives, some openings from the Greek Cypriot side. So far, the Christodoulidis government has been enjoying the intransigency of the Turkish Cypriot side, and they could easily get away with it. They were saying that they're in favor of a federal solution, and then, you know, they are committed to the United Nations Security Council resolutions on Cyprus. But I don't think that the UN is convinced that it's the Turkish Cypriot side that should, or they should be, that they should be convincing on.
Well, I think this is the discussion that I was alluding to before when it comes to finding the keys to unlock the situation. I think that being the side that is or should be most pressed for a solution, as it is the one that is still under a constitutional crisis, still under occupation, etc., you would expect this urgency. And I believe that this is what maybe the UN would also be expecting in this situation, taking in consideration, as we said, the 7 years of a stalemate. At the same time, regarding the Secretary General report, I think I've been covering the Cyprus problem long enough in order to be seeing the signs of what is going to be a report that will potentially have some references to the Greek Cypriot side that will not be pleasant for it.
Why?
And why do I say this? I mean, what are these signs that I'm referring to? I am referring to this sort of dispute between the Republic of Cyprus and the United Nations force on the island. Lately, we've seen the case of what have been called as the buffer zone migrants, 31 migrants that are being stuck on the buffer zone for more than a month. They came from the Turkish Cypriot side and they tried, or rather they were not allowed to seek asylum at the crossing points. Practice that has been taking place since at least 2020, and I'm referring to the rejection by the Republic of Cyprus to consider the crossing points as a point where asylum can be sought. Basically, the UN force is alluding to a pushback by the Republic of Cyprus on the buffer zone. We've seen Cyprus's interior minister making some references to Amphisip being complicit, in a sense, to what is happening, telling that the tents on the buffer zone had been set before the migrants had arrived. Interestingly enough, the Amphisip force chose, which it doesn't often do, it only did it once or twice in the past, it chose to refute this claim on Twitter. It didn't refer specifically to the interior minister, it referred to an article in Philelefteros. But what we are seeing here is a picture in which the Republic of Cyprus is leaking to the media this sort of disagreement or displeasure in the actions of the UN force in Cyprus. And normally when this happens, we are to assume that a negative or at least not a positive reference is coming up in a UN Secretary General report, and the government is preempting towards this. We've seen this happening multiple times in the past, and I think I would share your view of the fact that the report is not likely to in any way put the single blame on the Turkish Cypriot side, even though it is the one that has moved away from the framework, the agreed framework, and the bizonal bicommunal federation.
And what kind of openings and initiatives are we talking about when we mention that the Republic of Cyprus, the Christodoulidis government, is also expecting to take some initiatives? I have my own ideas on that, but how do you see it? What kind of, why should they make some openings if it's the Turkish Cypriot side that is rejecting the agreed framework?
Well, it is the Turkish Cypriot side that is rejecting the agreed framework, but we are, as we said before, 7 years in a stalemate, in a situation in which you have an aggravated occupation on the island, and in a situation in which the Republic of Cyprus should be feeling increasingly insecure in this setting. And I think it's openings in the sense of trying to increase cooperation, or at least get some a success story of cooperation on the island. I want you to share with us what your thoughts are on the issue. And I would just like to put a context in this, though, in order to see that, in fact, the Republic of Cyprus doesn't seem prepared to follow the course that you are outlining. Remember a few months ago, the Republic of Cyprus and President Christodoulidis, they had announced this famous list of 14 measures as measures of like a positive move towards the Turkish Cypriots. A number of them are still not even enforced. Things like the facilitation of the Agios Domitios crossing point, for instance. And it's an issue that has been tormenting Cypriots. And this goes to show that in terms of proclamations go, yeah, but even those measures that, as we said in our podcast before, they did not in any way go long enough, even those are not being enforced. So how can we expect something greater from the Greek Cypriot side? But what is your view on what could actually be opening?
I claim that my analysis will be historical and factual. The information that I have as a Cypriot who has been working on Cyprus problem, on the Cyprus problem, is that every time there is an interruption in the talks, every time the Greek Cypriot side think that it's not a fair game and they decide to seek for another option and opportunity, it's working against them. And the fact that you can put the blame on either side for Crans-Montana, but after 7 years of break, now we came back to the point where the Turkish/Turkish-Cypriot side are expecting more. And whether it is ethical, whether it is acceptable, whether it is fair, it's another discussion. I think the international community is convinced that for the Turkish-Cypriot side to come back to the table, they need to be lured. And for this, I think it might be said that they need a safe-facing opening so that they can abandon their two-state solution policy. Not completely, unfortunately, but at least to come back to the table, probably they will want some sort of a sign, a signal. Knowing that Turkey has been playing this bargaining game in diplomacy regionally and internationally in the last 20 years at least, very efficiently, we know that. So my view is that, unfortunately, Cyprus problem, nor the international politics, are not based on fairness, on whether it's right or wrong. Now, there is a talk, and it's not been reflected a lot, of the possibility of the Republic of Cyprus to appease help the Turkish/Turkish-Cypriot side to come back to the table. There is a talk about the famous 3D, whether it's going to be direct contacts, whether it's going to be direct flights, whether it's going to be direct trade, to make some opening towards the Turkey. So these are not necessarily even a low level of confidence building. We are not talking about opening new crossing points. We are not talking about recognizing the citizenship right of the children of the so-called mixed marriages. We are talking about big confidence building measures, big openings. And I think my contacts have been telling me that they are expecting such an opening from the Republic of Cyprus, from the Greek Cypriot side. Whether it's fair or not, it's another discussion. But of course, it also depends whether the Greek Cypriot side has this vision of for Cyprus, whether they think that they can sustain the status quo as it is, or whether they should be taking those steps to convince the other side for the talks. It seems that certain international actors are convinced that, yes, it is not acceptable for the Turkish side to insist on the two-state solution. However, for them to come back to the table, it's the responsibility of the Christodoulidis government to take that extra step.
I think here it's kind of a multifaceted issue, in the sense that, so you have on the one hand these big confidence building measures that you're referring to, which, yeah, I don't think anyone is expected to invent the wheel here. These things have been in discussion forever. They are always being delayed in the hope and expectation for a wider and comprehensive settlement. And this settlement never arrives. And so always, as you understand, especially at the time of such a deadlock, these ideas reemerge. And we should perceive these ideas reemerging as a consequence of our failure to reach a common ground and a comprehensive settlement. So we need to put this in the picture as well. But if you are in absence of a comprehensive settlement, if you are in absence of any goodwill, you are trying to work with what you have. And this is where these ideas come in the discussion. And they are being discussed as a way in order to have some small wins or some wins that could maybe put the focus somewhere else. But we need to understand that it's only happening because we are in absence of a comprehensive settlement. So that's where you go to the concept and the discussion of a comprehensive settlement then. And even there, we've seen a lot of discussion about the changing process, about something that will guarantee for the Turkish Cypriot side that if a new process starts and fails, they are going to be at a better standing than before.
This is what Özdil Nami has been actually voicing out for some time already. And I think he's not the only one saying this. For somebody who's not into Cyprus politics, Cyprus problem, it might sound unfair because there is one side which is not moving an inch. So because you cannot move that side, you try to convince the other side to take that extra step. And then it sounds like it's unfair. But in the long run, one should ask what is the vision of the Greek Cypriots for the future. I mean, would they want to continue playing this game of being right and being, you know, accepted by the international community without really solving the problem? Or are they committed? I'm not really sure if Christodoulidis' government is really committed to solving the Cyprus problem. I see a government which is trying to shove off internally that they're signing strategic agreements with Americans, that, you know, this has always been the case with Christodoulidis, with big international agreements, with Egypt, with Lebanon, with Greece, with, you know, this and that. But what's the strategy? What's the vision? I mean, what are we trying to achieve?
I think this attempt to portray Cyprus as big in the geopolitical context has been going on for a while. We discussed multiple times in the context of this podcast things like the so-called trilateral meetings between Greece, Cyprus, and Israel at a point. It was Egypt as well at some other point. You had the USA always being sort of pushing for these initiatives as well and supporting them. And now you have the situation in which Cyprus is discussing this strategic dialogue agreement with the USA. They are being very closely sort of working together when it comes to the aid towards Gaza. You had the Amalthea endeavor, and one cannot in any way say that it was successful in terms of its aims, but the Cyprus government can be using it in order to say, look, we are in the international scene and we are being discussed and they've got this very nice and new phrase that they are launching and using all the time, that Cyprus is part of the solution and not of the problem. So this is the dimension that the Republic of Cyprus wants to put things into. And you see the USA playing along in a way that it is allowing the Republic of Cyprus to cast its eyes away from its pending problem. It's like they have a new toy to play with. And in fact, we saw a recent interview by the Cypriot Minister of Foreign Affairs, Mr. Konstantinos Kompos, who dared, might I say, compare the strategic dialogue agreement with the USA with our accession to the European Union. So you see how they are trying to use these developments. But at the same time, the sad reality is that despite of all this, you still have a pending problem in the country. You still have a situation in which you are de facto losing control of the north, in which the Turkish Cypriots are being totally annihilated by Turkey. But at the same time, and this should also be of interest to the USA, you have a situation in the north where everything is like a black hole. It's a black hole of Turkish mafia. You now have Iranian, Israeli, Russian money flowing in. You don't know where this money is coming in. You have no way of actually influencing things there. So I cannot help but feel it's rather short-sighted. So well, I think we need to put this in the picture.
We said this over and over again. I mean, Cyprus needs to remember that it's a small country. And it is important for the small countries to act like a small country, meaning that you need to be friends with your neighbors. You need to try to, yes, play an active diplomacy, but you are not a key player in the sense that you don't have a big population, you don't have a big army, you don't have, you know, you are a small country. And you need to remember this every time. And, but... whether it's the culture or whether it's this Hellenistic background of, you know, diplomacy, trying to make strategy and, you know, the vision and then multifaceted, multidimensional diplomacy and all that. At the end of the day, you know, half of your country is under the control of another country. And nobody really cares about the fact that it is being controlled by that country. And okay, you get the sympathies, and every now and then there are talks, and you know, it starts and it stops again. At the end of the day, this doesn't change the reality. When it comes to this strategic agreement with the United States, apparently there seems to be some sort of an American initiative to involve Greece, Cyprus, to have a new fault line on this part of the world. I don't know what the EU is doing at the moment. They're probably busy to, you know, rethink their structures. Cyprus, Cypriots, the elites, the visionaries of Cyprus need to think what their end game is, what their plan is. All right, you are having this strategic agreement. So what's next? What's your plan? I mean, are you trying to alienate the Turkish Cypriot side? Do you really need to? They are already alienating themselves. But at the same time, they are an 85 billion population country, and whether you like them or not, they're there. You're on this part. So I don't know what's the strategy there. I don't know what's the end game there. And that's, yes, all these strategic agreements are good, but...
I think that what you're saying is particularly true if one considers what I said before about Cyprus now claiming to be part of the solution. But if you are claiming this, and if you are having access to this strategic dialogue agreement, let's say, you should be in a position to use it proactively, to use it positively, to use it in a way to promote what should be the end goal, which should be the comprehensive solution to the Cyprus problem, rather than using such developments as yet another way for the status quo to be entrenched, and for you to feel more at comfort with the status quo, to think that you are more at comfort with the status quo. And I think that this is the vision that, as you said, that we are lacking in this process. And one could further argue that even our accession to the European Union was not seen in this way, in the way for us to be present in developments, to be working towards our comprehensive solution constructively, rather than feeling so-called protected by our EU membership. At the same time, you have the European Union trying to also work on its relationship with Turkey at the moment, but you also have Greece trying to also mend its ties. We've seen unprecedented progress in some areas and in the facilitation of visits, for instance, between some of the islands. There are no longer any military exercises upsetting the situation. And so in all this, where can one find Cyprus? And the sad reality is that the realities on the ground are getting worse and worse in a setting in which all other players are fixing their ties.
where is Russia in all that? Because historically, Republic of Cyprus, the Greek Cypriot leadership, they had at least, to say the least, good relations with Russia. It seems that Cyprus has joined openly in the Western camp. They are part of the EU. And after Nasrallah's, Hezbollah's threats on Cyprus, accusing Cyprus to harbor and support Israel, there is even a talk about NATO membership of Cyprus, which is, of course, which would, even if in theory we can assume that the Republic of Cyprus decides to join the NATO, it will be requiring Turkey's approval. And if the big players decided that this is going to be the case, I don't think Turkey will be an obstacle. They will probably be seeking some sort of a return out of this. So in this
you need
context,
an invitation to join NATO, and I don't think such an invitation is coming anytime soon. So I think, I don't think this is in any way realistic. In fact, even President Christodoulidis said so a while ago, who said that it's no time to be discussing a NATO membership. I don't see the discussion on NATO being in any way realistic in absence of a solution. Yes, maybe in the context of a solution, in a situation in which the security framework that had been discussed back in 2017 is no longer viable because it included Russia, of course, and a very heightened presence by the Security Council. I think that would be difficult to achieve at the moment. But I don't think a discussion on NATO is in any way grounded. I think it's just a playground again for people to be dividing amongst themselves. Well, Russia is increasing its presence in the north, and I think it has seen its impact in the south increasingly weakened. Obviously, they still have the soft power when it comes through the church and through these sort of affiliations, but anything we used to see in the past in terms of Cyprus being an offshore paradise and everything, I think we no longer see this. Having said this, and I would like to point this out because I perceived it as one of the examples of how disinformation goes. We recently had those statements by the leader of Hezbollah against Cyprus, and you had this random headline and random article that appeared in what I think it was a Serbian news site that was titled NATO's Secretary General is saying that NATO will never help Cyprus in case of an attack by Hezbollah. And that was a clear case of disinformation, and there was nowhere such an interview to be found or such a statement to be found. But it was discussed in some circles, I included in what we call this sort of Russian disinformation attempts. And what I'm trying to show here is that obviously you have this sort of attempts by Russia or Russian agents, and you see Russia moving further away from the Republic, but the unknown factor is what is now happening in the north, is the extent to which the impact of Russia and Russian money is influencing the north, and which is the million-dollar question, whether the time is ripe or whether Russia feels that the time is ripe to play its cards at the UN Security Council as well when it comes to ANFISIP and the UN force in Cyprus.
can you explain it more to those who didn't understand what you're trying to say?
No, I think that for years you've had, a Russian agreement at the Security Council level about the UN force in Cyprus, the bi-zonal, bi-communal federation as the framework. Well, we've been saying for long that in the long run, maybe Russia would pull its hearts at the Security Council and try to have this basis changed. And up to now, we've been assessing that they wouldn't feel that the time is ripe. But I think that as we see this further distancing from the sides, and as we see the impact of Russia in the north increasing, we should be in a position to discuss
The possibility of a Russian veto for the extension of ANFISIP, which would mean that United Nations will no longer be stationed in the buffer zone in Cyprus, and that would leave Republic of Cyprus alone, face to face with Turkish troops and Turkey, and meaning, of course, solidifying the Green Line as a permanent division line.
Yeah, or even a challenge to the framework of a solution. So all these need to be put into context, and we need to be in a position to anticipate such scenarios as well.
Should we expect some sort of an opening from Christodoulidis anytime soon?
I honestly don't see any such sign.
There is this elections in the US, so American focus, despite all, is now focused on elections. We don't know what the outcome will be. The EU is now also busy resettling, reshaping its institutions, especially after the European Parliament elections. We are now having a new Secretary General at NATO. The international community is busy with Israel-Palestine conflict. There is
not as busy as they should.
And also, we still don't see any light at the end of the tunnel in Ukraine. So, in this context, I think people are all over the place. Looking at the political parties in the Greek Cypriot community, they are also all over the place. We used to see strong leadership on that front as well. I don't know what and how DC and AKEL are playing their part. Now that we have a Greek Cypriot leader, a Republic of Cyprus president, who is not hailing from either of the party, that's also another issue. And as we've seen in the European Parliament elections, people are responding negatively to the impotence of the political parties and political life in the Greek Cypriot community. When it comes to the Turkish Cypriot community, Mr. Tatar, I'm not expecting anything. He's just going around and talking about Cyprus problem in different towns in Turkey, and sometimes going to Australia, going to African countries. I don't know to whom he's addressing to. And in this context, I don't know how we can evaluate the local political context on the island.
Well, I don't think that there is any room for Cyprus to come into the picture at the moment in terms of an initiative from the international community. And that's where the importance of leaders comes, the importance of domestic leaders, I mean, in order to put the light back into the situation, or in order for them with their actions to create something, or to create the ground for something to happen when it comes to the Cypriot dispute and situation. Well, and secondly, to your reference about the Greek Cypriot parties, I think that, and because you asked before about any potential for an opening by President Christodoulidis, I think that we need to be in a position to acknowledge that the election results kind of showed that the political parties that are supporting Christodoulidis are being increasingly weakened. In any way one sees it, it could be either a positive or a negative when it comes to a Cyprus problem initiative. So if one looks at the bright side, one would say, okay, Christodoulidis now can feel that the political parties are anyway not strong enough, so he can have more leeway for him to do whatever he wants if he decided to dictate the direction in a determined way towards a Cyprus problem solution. On the negative side, which I believe it will in the end be the one to prevail, one could say that the fact that the political parties that are supporting Christodoulidis are being weakened further weakens Christodoulidis himself, because this doesn't leave him any room for maneuver. He is anyway feeling increasingly pressured about passing laws in the parliament, and he might feel that he doesn't have in any way the backing of the political parties behind him to move forward towards a determined approach in the Cyprus problem. So he might opt for basically not shaking the waters. Having said this, in the Turkish Cypriot community, we are going to soon enter the Turkish Cypriot leadership elections process, and that will further, I believe, hinder the possibility for anything to happen, because the candidates will be trying to balance themselves between getting elected as leaders of the Turkish Cypriot community and having, obviously, Turkey not going against them, which would be important for them. So it's a situation in which, again, we are entering waters in which the Cyprus problem will be difficult to come in the spotlight again.
And in less than a month, we are going to be having the anniversary of 50th anniversary of 20th of July. Half a century we are talking about now. And it seems that Mr. Erdogan is coming with the opposition leader, the new opposition leader in Turkey. Together, they're coming to Cyprus. And the Greek prime minister will also be here. So when it comes to their own affairs between Turkey and Greece, they are all trying to set things up. I wonder what they're going to say each other on both sides of the divide on the anniversary. On that note, we also remember how CHP boycotted Erdogan speaking to the Turkish Cypriot Assembly last time. And then in order to make sure that this is not repeated again, Tufan Erihürman and Fikri Toros have been invited to Turkey 2-3 days ago. So they visited AK Party and they visited also Republican People's Party. And they met the Turkish chamber. And apparently, I think they are being told to, you know, not to repeat the same mistake again. When it comes to the Turkish Cypriot elections, we probably be having more than 1 year now. And things can change. Erhurman is still look as if it's a strong candidate, but we still don't know how things will be changing in a year's time. Yeah, so this is a typical summer of Cyprus. But you didn't tell us your experience about, you know, your first active experience in active politics in Cyprus.
Well, it was kind of fascinating, interesting, hectic. It was a nice experience. I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was obviously when you're doing something without any resources, it has a great toll on you in every way. But it was a nice journey that will, in fact, continue. And we are, you know, setting out the path for the future at the moment. But I want to share something that has to do with the Cyprus problem in terms of this journey. And what particularly impressed me is the fact that because I was hosted in a number of podcasts, and obviously you discuss your past and you discuss Cyprus, and obviously I was receiving constant questions on the Cyprus problem. And in some of these podcasts, I was explaining what a federation is. I was explaining the historical context and everything. And I was particularly impressed at the way these explanations were received. It was as though a lot of people didn't know things. A lot of people were not in any way aware what a bizonal, bicommunal federation is. And I think that kind of it created in me, but also in the Volt Party in general, this understanding that we need to push more for this enlightenment, for these discussions on the Cyprus problem. In many of the social media comments that we are receiving in terms of these podcasts and these discussions on the Cyprus problem, we receive many questions on issues that affect either the process or the federation model, etc. And we are very keen in order to start answering these questions, in order to basically shed some light on this. It's funny, you would say, because in this podcast we are discussing how the Bizonal Bicommunal Federation is fulfillment is actually failing, but at the same time I'm getting excitement and drive out of you know, explaining to people what this is. But regardless of what happens, you need a historical context, you need a historical understanding of why we are discussing what we are discussing.
How did people react, Andromache, when you were advocating closer relationships with the Turkish Cypriots and that Republic of Cyprus should extend its hand towards the Turkish Cypriots? What kind of reactions have you received?
Look, I think that on the one hand, you obviously get the normal reactions that are always to be expected, you know, these sort of attacks and calling you names and, you know, this guy is paying you, or the other country is paying you. But okay, this, I have to say that when it comes to social media attacks and entering politics, I think that my 10 years of being active in the civil society on the Cyprus problem, it really sort of armed me in the face of this, because there was barely anything that I haven't heard before, or there was barely any attack that I haven't received before. So I was kind of, you know, it's like I went into training ground before I entered politics. But at the same time, what is really sort of rejuvenating and encouraging is that in the midst of all this, when these ideas or our ideas get a bit more spotlight or are a bit more discussed, there are also people who are drawn by them. And there are also people who are interested in hearing what you have to say, especially when you try to speak in a way that doesn't polarize, or you don't put names on the other, and you just try to seek the ground for your own opinions to be heard without trying to sort of attack anyone else. So I think in that setting, I see an increasing understanding on behalf of the Greek Cypriot community about the need to look the Turkish Cypriots in the eyes, and about the need to start discussing our relationship with the Turkish Cypriots. And obviously all this comes in the context of greater threat by Turkey. So this is how they perceive it. But this is a positive development, I would say. The problem now is that you also need political leaders to be articulating a vision out of this, rather than simply having the understanding that we need to see what we can do with the Turkish Cypriot community. But you need to have leaders to show you the way, or to articulate specifically what it is that needs to be done. And that is, I think, what we are currently lacking in the wider picture.
How do you see the future of World Party then?
I think that we are very eager at the moment. We are obviously, we expected a higher percentage, but, you know, as a political analyst, as I am, I always say that when you have a situation in which a single candidate running on his own gets a 20% of the vote, then you are talking about a phenomenon that kind of didn't leave any room for any spills to go out anywhere else. And I think that as the polls were showing the increasing popularity of Fidias, I think the moment that it became possible for him to be elected, it kind of became that sort of current that drove everyone towards him, because it was possible and it could be made possible. And so as a party, we're not pessimistic. We know very well that what Volt is suggesting is groundbreaking in many respects. And our ideas on a number of issues are groundbreaking, not from the perspective of the society, but from the perspective of having a political party actually voicing them and embracing them in the way that we are doing. And we fully understand that we have a lot to do in order to work for this. And I think that if there is one key message from this whole process, it should be that we all need to acknowledge that we might need to change our style or the way that we communicate. We need to make things more simple for people. We need to be in a position to engage more with people. So I think there are many lessons out of this. We are very eager to continue. And I would just like to put the final point when it comes to the Turkish Cypriots. And I'm going to give my opinion, but I think you should also share with us what you think about what was one of the, I think for me, the most disappointing development of the elections, which was the very low turnout by the Turkish Cypriots. Low turnout when it comes to what was anticipated, or when it comes to the attempts by the European Commission in order to encourage wider participation by the Turkish Cypriots. So what is it? What is your view on this? And then I'm going to share my thoughts.
Sometimes things are just very simple. You wake up in the morning, you wash your face, and it's hot, very hot outside. So when you vote, you just step out your house and go to your, you know, primary school in your neighborhood. The ballot box is waiting for you. You just vote and then go back to, you know, continue your day on the beach. So I think this thing about Turkish Cypriots not participating in the elections, I think it's the result of the complete misunderstanding of the whole problem. First of all, as a Turkish Cypriot, you need to be living close to any crossing point. And you need to go to the crossing point, show your ID, and then go into the buffer zone, and then go show your ID again, and try to find somebody who, the volunteers who will be taking you to the crossing, to the ballot box. And then you go and you don't know the system. And some people have been returned and some people have voted. And the entire campaign was in the Turkish Cypriot community was designed to support a single candidate. And not many people were convinced that they are willing to do that. And I think it's only fair to see that, you know, more than 5,000 Turkish Cypriots went to the ballot boxes. I don't know if we just compare the percentage of participation in Nicosia on both sides of the divide, it might give us a better picture. But also congratulations, Walt came second in the Turkish Cypriot precinct in the ballot boxes. I saw many people who actually never, they never wanted to vote, but I saw them that they voting, they were saying that they would vote for you, particularly Andromache, because they heard you, they've been following you, they read your articles in the Turkish Cypriot newspapers, and they thought that they should really support those people who are voicing the ideas that they share. And that's, I think, the main reason. I think many Turkish Cypriots don't think that this particular election was relevant to their daily problems, their economic problems, that their problems about electricity cuts, that they're, you know, just choosing one Turkish Cypriot or, you know, choosing any just EU candidates for the European Parliament. I think that's my understanding.
Yeah, thank you for your comments. I was also particularly encouraged by the reception we had by many Turkish Cypriots, even those who didn't vote for us, because we need to be in a, I think we got something like 700 votes from the Turkish Cypriots, but we need to be in a position to appreciate, which for us and for me personally, it was clear all along that the Turkish Cypriots would in the end prioritize voting for the person that could, or that they felt that had the greatest potential for him being elected. And that was always our understanding. And I think that with the Turkish Cypriots that went to the ballot, regardless, I'm referring to the ones that voted for candidates who support the federation. But I think that those Turkish Cypriots who went to the ballot and cast their vote towards someone who supports the federation, we are in the same camp in any case. So that for us has always been clear. At the same time, we joined this race and we joined the political party system, let's say, in full awareness and understanding of the current situation on the island. And division, partition has its own consequences and fait accompli on the island. And part of this is this distance that the Turkish Cypriots feel towards what they perceive as, you know, Greek Cypriot political parties or the European Union itself. So I think that that is on us. It is on us to change this perception. It is on us to work on creating our liaisons and contacts and groups and activity in the north and in the Turkish Cypriot community. It is on us to recreate hope, let's say, when it comes to any political development on the island. So we were, and I was always very well aware of
that. Well, on that note, maybe we say the final words. I think this is the 58th anniversary of the division, geographical division of our country. And the fact that we are still trying to play a diplomatic game in the international scene without really addressing the number one problem of our country that will affect us and the future generations is our constant failure. However, I think we still have people still understanding the issues. I have been hearing a lot about redesigning the process, involving the civil society, the citizens into the process because the process had been designed long time ago based on the leaders. So this is also a hopeful development. And the fact that more and more people continue to cross despite the obstacles, I think it is still a hopeful development. But the international positionings in that area, again, over and over again, shows us that this problem on this part of the world cannot be sustained. And the fact that we are not in the middle of a crisis doesn't mean that it is never going to be the case. So our only hope is to focus and see if there will be more opportunities to solve the Cyprus problem. So I continue, and I want to finish this my part on with these words.
Yeah, I think we've done a lot of analysis today, but on a personal note and on a note as people who are working for peace and for greater cooperation between the sides and understanding and empathy, for me it is striking how these differing narratives are becoming entrenched at a higher institutional level. It is also particularly alarming in the Greek Cypriot community how we are slowly sort of disregarding the coup d'etat from our historical understanding of what happened. And when you take away the coup d'etat, which was the last bit that was allowing any sense of let's say, blame or guilt on the Greek Cypriot shoulders, when you lift that away, the story comes complete about, you know, this complete victimization, and it becomes entrenched. You see what is happening. And this is something, obviously, that as Cypriots who want the people of the island to come together in understanding of our past, in full appreciation of what brought us here, and with a common determination to look forward with a common vision for the future of the island, I think that us Cypriots should be alarmed in this setting. And we should raise our voices more, of course.
Next program, we will have a better picture after Madame Olguin meets the leaders, and let's see how things, if ever, will be evolving in the second half of this year. So on that note, maybe we say goodbye.
Goodbye.
The first trilingual podcast station of Cyprus. Island Talks. Open. Diverse. Free.